brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, September 28th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Bland, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We're going to start off this week talking about the story of the week, the devastation in Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria. We're going to have defense reporter Jacqueline Klimas in the studio. She was in Puerto Rico this week with the military as recovery efforts are ongoing there. Take a listen to her conversation with Senator Marco Rubio on the plane.
What are your questions as you prepare to land in Puerto Rico?
I think we have to kind of understand there's a couple challenges in these storms. The first is, what are your immediate needs? What do you need in the next 24, 48, 72 hours, 7 days, 10 days? Life and safety type issues. And then sort of long term, begin to understand what are the long term challenges to restoring power and other critical infrastructure.
We'll also be talking once again about Alabama. Senator Luther Strange lost his Republican primary in the special election there on Tuesday. Former state Supreme Court Judge Roy Moore, a very controversial, firebrand conservative Republican, will be the nominee. We're going to talk a little bit about what that means and what it would mean if he makes it to the Senate. Eliana Johnson has a really good story out this week about the establishment Republican nightmare scenario that is looming on the horizon. And it's not so great for Democrats either. And then for our final segment this week, we're going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump and the NFL. The president set off a storm of protests among players and some owners in the league last week with his comments about players choosing to kneel during the national anthem to protest racial injustice. We're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between sports and politics and race in the country and where this whole thing might go from here. Just a few housekeeping notes before we jump into all that. Remember, if you have questions, you can email us, and please do, at nerdcast@politico.com. We'd love to hear from you. Along the same lines, we'd really appreciate it if you have the time, subscribe, rate us, and write a written review of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. The feedback's going to help us make a better show and expand the audience. So please, if you can, subscribe, rate us, write a written review. All right, and here with us, senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian.
Hey, Scott.
And this week, making her Nerdcast debut, defense reporter Jacqueline Klimas.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So Jacqueline is here to kick off our first data point, and that is 1.5 million. That is the approximate number of people in Puerto Rico still without drinking water since Hurricane Maria hit the U.S. territory a week ago. That's according to a Defense Department estimate out on Wednesday. Jacqueline, you were on the ground in Puerto Rico earlier this week reporting on the recovery efforts there. Can you describe the scene for us?
There was really just devastation everywhere. There's really no sense of normalcy on the island right now. We were mostly in downtown San Juan. And the thing that was really striking was there are just no people around. There are, you know, there was a Cold Stone Creamery. So there are trappings of normal American life, but just no people as people are still trying to dig out from this. And another thing that was really striking was that all the leaves are off the trees. I grew up in Connecticut, so I'd never really seen a bad storm like this. And the trees, it just looks like a fire came through. And there are just, you know, large, like, stumps sticking up, basically. Lots of overturned trees, kind of chunks of metal along the side of the highway all twisted up that had been roofs ripped off. It was really, really pretty striking.
How did you get there in the first place? I mean, there's all, the island, as you said, has been, like, totally devastated by this. It's the every bit of normal logistics has gone out the window.
Right. So I actually was invited to travel with the Coast Guard Commandant. He was going down with some lawmakers and some other leaders in the Coast Guard to see what kind of supplies were needed on the ground, see how the recovery efforts were going firsthand. So we flew out of Reagan Airport here in D.C. and we landed at a smaller airport outside of San Juan. There was a lot of issues where we didn't want to land at the main airport because everyone is trying to use it and it was kind of overloaded. So we ended up at the smaller airport outside. And when we landed, there was this hangar that had just been completely destroyed, just basically leveled. So kind of right on the ground, you got a real impression of how bad it was.
And so did did your trip, I know you were traveling with all bigwigs, but did you guys get to see average people, like get into any neighborhoods and just see how people are coping?
We didn't get too far outside of the city, so we didn't get into the rural parts where things are very bad. But we did visit, we visited mostly with Coast Guardsmen to kind of see how they're responding. We saw a Coast Guard building that just the roof was completely torn off. You could see this guy standing in it. And we also got to visit with families of Coast Guardsmen who were serving down there who had stayed and weathered the storm. They're all still without power. One woman talked about how she just tried to get her kids to sleep through the night because the wind was so scary. They were sort of freaking out, and she just tried to get them to go back to bed. So we did get to talk to some normal people who were down there.
What's the situation down there right now with regard to electricity, water, food, shelter? Is relief, you were reporting on the relief efforts. Is there a sense that this is happening fast enough to help out the people there? I mean, 1.4 million people without water sounds really a scary number to me.
Absolutely. I mean, they're expected to not have power for months. Definitely not a lot of access to clean water. A lot of people's homes were destroyed. And because it's an island, they can't just ship in temporary housing. So these people have nowhere safe to live, which then, you know, you're in the tropics. You have the issue of dengue fever or other mosquito-borne diseases. So there's definitely – they're in a bad situation. I mean, the Defense Department is down there. There are 10,000 FEMA responders down there. So the U.S. is responding, but there's definitely a sense among local leaders that they're not responding fast enough. I mean, there's a fuel shortage and just an issue getting supplies there that people who are officials down there are saying that more people are going to die if the response isn't stepped up.
What's next in Washington in terms of making that happen? Earlier this morning, we saw President Trump announce a big move in terms of the shipping that you were just talking about.
Yeah, I mean, waiving the Jones Act is definitely a big step forward. My understanding is that the president actually lifted it for 10 days. There were people on Capitol Hill who were calling on it for it to be lifted for a year.
Can you just explain briefly what the Jones Act is?
Sure. So it's an old law that requires that ships going from one American port to another must be American-owned and American-made. So waiving it will allow ships that are either foreign-owned or foreign-made to help bring supplies and ideally get supplies there faster. And it was waived for both Texas and Florida to recover from previous hurricane damage. So this is a big step forward, but it definitely doesn't go as far as some in Congress were hoping for. Their logic on the Hill is that the recovery for this is going to take so long. People in Puerto Rico shouldn't have to be paying more for water or gas, or the prices go up when this is in effect because foreign ships can't come in. So it would their theory is that it would aid in recovery if it was waived for longer.
And you said Puerto Rico's advocates on the Hill. Who are Puerto Rico's advocates on the Hill? Because it's a U.S. territory. They have a non-voting member in the House, but they don't have anyone in the Senate. They don't have an actual vote in Congress. So who's kind of driving things in terms of trying to get the funds appropriated, trying to move things and lobby to make stuff happen for them?
Right. So there's one non-voting representative for Puerto Rico and one for the Virgin Islands. And they're really trying to put together this coalition on Capitol Hill that will have more of a voice and that will be able to vote, because they said that they're really afraid that the damage down here is going to be forgotten because it's not a state. So they're trying to put together this group of lawmakers. Senator Rubio obviously plays a big role in that. He was down there seeing the damage and talking with people, and he promised to be a strong supportive voice in Washington for them. Senator Nelson has also expressed this. The other senator from Florida, which has the state has a large Puerto Rican population. More broadly, the lawmakers for the region said that they really rely on lawmakers from Florida and New York, because there are such large Puerto Rican constituencies there. We've also seen Representative Velasquez from New York. She was the first Puerto Rican woman elected to Congress. So she has been a strong advocate. She led a letter yesterday with Representative Adam Smith. It was 145 Democrats asking for the Defense Department to step up its response. So we have seen voting lawmakers take an interest in this, and they're the ones that lawmakers from the region are hoping will help push it forward.
Unfortunately for Puerto Rico, there are, aside from the big communities that you mentioned in Florida and New York, there are other sizable communities that are often overlooked, and they'll be able to, I think, bring some clout to this process. Whether you're talking about Pennsylvania has a pretty significant Puerto Rican population, so members from Pennsylvania are going to have to get involved in one degree or another. Chicago has a huge Puerto Rican population, so there will be some impetus coming from Congress.
What is that going to look like? What is the congressional action going to look like? I mean, when we were talking in preparation for this, one of the things that sets what's going on in Puerto Rico apart from the hurricane that hit Florida or Texas is the fact that this looks like it is going to be a much, much longer recovery effort.
Absolutely. I mean, Texas and Florida, both everyone's talking about sort of a one-time infusion of cash and then they'll be able to recover themselves. But Puerto Rico, in addition to dealing with the storm, is also dealing with this debt crisis that they've been plagued with. And now with the storm, kind of the only way for them to get out of this debt is through tourism and agriculture, are their two main industries. And those don't appear to be profitable in the foreseeable future. I mean, I don't see any tourists going to Puerto Rico. So that's a huge issue. And experts are saying that if Congress actually wants to fix this, it's going to take a multi-year effort. And when I asked Senator Rubio if he thinks there's an appetite in the Congress to do this, he basically said he doesn't know, but he hopes so. So it's kind of unclear what the path forward but it's going to take a lot of money to put them on a good road.
There's also political fallout in the U.S. too, which is, I think, a fascinating component of this. I mean, you're going to see a mass exodus of citizens from Puerto Rico, and many of them are going to likely end up in Florida, where already that is the fastest growing Hispanic population, and it's beginning to alter Florida politics, and I think it will on a much bigger scale now. And what is notable about that is this is not like a group. The Puerto Rican Americans are American citizens. A lot of people don't know that, and there is not the traditional. There's not going to be a waiting period. They can vote right away, so they will have an impact right away once they move in to Florida. Many of them will go to the Orlando area, and that could have an impact in right away and. If not 2018, certainly in 2020, in one of the biggest and most important swing states in the nation.
That's such an interesting point. The large population movements are going to be triggered by this, and we're not going to have a sense for a little while just how large it's going to be continuing.
Absolutely. And the lawmakers from Puerto Rico are actually really concerned about this because the people who are going to be able to leave are going to be the people who have the money to leave, who have the resources to get jobs there. So who's going to be left behind on the island are the elderly and the poor, which then leaves Puerto Rico in even a more disadvantageous spot to be able to even start to rebuild their economy.
Wow. What should we be looking out for over the next week in terms of the progress on the recovery, the progress on getting people water and shelter and food and keeping the death toll? What is the death toll at this point?
So the last number I saw for the death toll was I think it was 16. But people are definitely expecting that to go up if help doesn't get there soon. We're hearing reports of people who haven't had dialysis in days or their respirators are not working because there's no power. We just heard about the San Juan mayor talked about two people who died in a hospital because there was no diesel to keep running their life support. So without these kind of basic human needs, I would absolutely expect the death toll to go up. And the Defense Department is working to get there. I mean, they're sending their hospital ship, the USNS Comfort. It's supposed to be leaving the U.S. on Friday and get there midweek next week. So we're definitely seeing the Pentagon response and the U.S. response pick up. The issue is just how quickly it can speed up, ramp up.
And did you get a sense when you were down there of what the impression is of the Trump administration's response? Because certainly here you could sense that there was a building narrative in the early days that the Trump administration was really slow off the mark. And from, you know, looking at his tweets, he was clearly paying much more attention to the NFL than Puerto Rico. And my impression is that only in the last few days did the administration understand this building bad narrative about not paying attention. And then the president went out there and talked about everyone is saying what an amazing job we've done, which to me is always the telltale sign from Trump. That's like his nervous tick. When he says everyone is saying or people are telling me, means the opposite is true. The exact opposite is true. And so to me, that's why you saw the quick action on the Jones Act waiver, because they understood that. Did you get a feel for what people think about the pace of the response?
Sure. I mean, people are absolutely calling for more of a response. We've heard that. I mean, I heard that when I was down there, and we've heard it since in different interviews. You know, the governor is just calling for more resources, for more DOD resources, for things to pick up. But I feel like the NFL narrative here has been big. No one there is talking about that. They don't have the time or the bandwidth to even care sort of what the president is tweeting about. They just need basic things like food and water.
All right. Well, I guess we'll be watching that as it continues. It's going to be a long recovery effort, and I'm sure you're going to be covering it for quite some time now in terms of what the Coast Guard and others are doing to make it happen. Jacqueline, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
All right, let's move into our second segment this week. We have national political reporter Eliana Johnson back with us to talk this time.
Hello.
All right. Our data point is 54.6%. That is the share of the vote. Alabama Republican Roy Moore got in Tuesday's Senate primary in the state, knocking out appointed Senator Luther Strange, who was endorsed by President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. It is the first time since 2012 that a sitting senator has lost a primary, although Strange was just appointed earlier this year to fill the vacancy left by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So there's a caveat there, but still big news in the Senate. Eliana, Roy Moore could charitably be described as provocative. He's called for homosexuality to be illegal. He's called for Congress to refuse to swear in a Muslim House member in the past. Democrats are livid. They're pouring money into his opponent's campaign. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But he could be a big problem for Republicans in the Senate. This is Alabama. He's the favorite going into the special general election. And you wrote today he could also be the start of an even bigger nightmare scenario, as you described it, for Senate Republicans.
Yeah, he's a colorful character, to put it charitably, unusual guy. But yeah, I think there's no hiding the fact that the former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon is determined to turn Mitch McConnell into what Nancy Pelosi has been for Democrats in recent years, which is a weight around the necks of Democratic incumbents, and to use him as an anchor to weigh down Republican incumbents this year and to boost insurgent candidates, not just in Alabama, as Roy Moore very successfully did, but across the country to boost insurgents. And I think the bipartisan nightmare scenario that I referred to in my piece, which would be just as bad for Democrats as for Republicans, would be that Republicans do succeed in picking up a couple of seats in 2018, but that those seats are held by insurgent candidates like Roy Moore, who I don't think could be counted on by Mitch McConnell to toe the line when it comes to voting, and who may very well vote against him for House Speaker. I think it's something that could really imperil McConnell's leadership.
For Senate Majority Leader.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, Moore had said, or Moore's campaign had said earlier this week, that he was not on board with the current Republican health care bill that was going in the Senate. And when you've got a 52-seat majority, every vote counts. For what you said, let's take a listen to what Steve Bannon said earlier this week at Moore's victory rally.
And you're going to see in state after state after state, people that follow the model of Judge Moore, that do not need to raise money from the elites, from the crony capitalists, from the fat cats in Washington, D.C., New York City, Silicon Valley.
What do you think about this, Charlie?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, Bannon is beginning to look like the leader of a third party, an emerging third party. Bannon, I think, has a very – first of all, I think Bannon's power and clout is exaggerated. I'm of the school of thought that thinks Breitbart's clout is exaggerated, but I mean it's there, and I think he's stirring up a lot of a lot of resistance within the party, and he is going to be a catalyst for many of these candidates from what I guess I would call the non-governance wing of the Republican Party, the Chris McDaniels in Mississippi. You're going to see a Bannonite come out of Tennessee, and in fact that may have played a role in Bob Corker's decision not to run for re-election. Bannon appears to be going on a recruiting swing to find these folks. I mean, they want to run. In all of these places, the Republican Party is transitioning. The populist conservative wing is on the rise. And when you have a figurehead like Bannon recruiting them, clearly it's going to have an impact, especially now that they have a result to point to. In fact, I saw where in Pennsylvania that Jack Wagner took a flight to a conservative conference with Bannon. So clearly Bannon is thinking about
governor there.
Yes, I'm sorry. And so clearly Bannon is thinking about the whole of the map. It's a very ambitious vision he has. He's not just talking about one race.
What is not exaggerated is the disgust and the anger of the Republican, you know, quote unquote, grassroots. And what Bannon and Breitbart have done is put some kind of organizational structure around that, which didn't previously exist. But the sense in which I do think that that's important is that the Tea Party candidates of 2010 and 2012 were actually united in some kind of ideological vision of smaller government, lower taxes, and so on. And you saw the formation of a Tea Party caucus in the House that's become something of a power center there. And Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee did become allies, at least for a time, in the Senate and worked together on legislation. I don't see a similar ideological coherence among the anti-establishment candidates popping up, except their opposition to somebody like McConnell. So it's unclear to me how exactly, if they showed up in the Senate, that they would work together except for sowing chaos. And in that sense, I do think that Bannon and these guys he's working with simply exist to tear down existing structures rather than to build anything up in their place. Like, I mean, what do Kid Rock and, Roy Moore have in common?
They have one-syllable first and last names.
I mean, beyond that, you know, Kid Rock is like this vulgar rapper.
I do think Charlie's point about, you know, whether or not we might be overstating Bannon's influence is an interesting one. But I think that to what you said, Charlie, and to what you said, Eliana, about what he's doing, the fact that someone's out there whispering in the ears of some of these candidates that, like, yes, you can do it, you can take on incumbent, I think is the most interesting part about this, because we've seen in the past few election cycles, we've seen that there's been this anger out there toward Republican incumbents, especially a lot of the older Republican senators. But the candidates who have risen up to or who have been there to take advantage of it have not been all that great. We've seen the more viable, essentially, candidates decide not to run. And to have someone like Bannon out there finding these people, talking to them and being like, hey, you could do it and kind of trying to put this together, I think is the interesting part, pushing people to get in position to take advantage of this this situation.
Look, I think the window for – people talked about the Overton window shifting during the 2016 presidential campaign. It has shifted in the midterm elections too with Roy Moore's victory. And I think that the Republican establishment – is reassessing what the definition of a viable candidate is, because nobody would have thought that Roy Moore was a viable senatorial candidate before now. And so I do think that Republican leaders are looking anew at the Senate map and at these potential anti-incumbent primary challengers and thinking about who they really need to take seriously. Including Kid Rock.
One caveat here that we should mention is that Roy Moore has been elected statewide twice in Alabama.
Sure.
He's a former Supreme Court justice. He's been on the ballot before. He had, over the course of a long political career, had built up a large base. There aren't a ton of people like that out there.
I think that's a fair point. It's one that I made in my piece. However, the folks working for Luther Strange said to me that this was far less about the Ten Commandments issue or the base that Roy Moore had built up in Alabama, but rather their polling really suggested that it was his campaign against Mitch McConnell that was really the powerful determinant in this race, and that McConnell's numbers you know, he wasn't necessarily all that well known, but they just plummeted over the course of this race. In many ways, Donald Trump has helped to make Mitch McConnell famous and to turn him into the Nancy Pelosi of the right. And that's something that's easily nationalized and carried across all these different races.
But the problem is that Alabama is so unique in its political character. It was almost like a perfect storm that Roy Moore got elected in Alabama. You're not going to see those circumstances elsewhere because you've got, number one, the questions surrounding the appointment of Luther Strange from the governor who was about to leave office. So you've got some sort of, some unsavory,
swampy
details hovering in the background of that appointment. You've got a state with a very long history of colorful populist characters, and Moore is really in the latest line of that. You've got a culture there that I think is more amenable to the kinds of out of the mainstream views of somebody like Roy Moore. Like, it's hard for me to see that happening in a lot of states, you know, whether it's a Pennsylvania or a Midwestern state or, you know, a Wisconsin or somewhere like that. It could happen. I'm not saying it can't because of the way the Republican Party is evolving. But again, I mean, I think Alabama is so unique.
Well, I think, Eliana, what you were saying is essentially it wouldn't necessarily be a Roy Moore-esque candidate who could do this. It would be someone who's united with Roy Moore only in their hatred for Mitch McConnell, who could then, you know, potentially give Senator Dean Heller some trouble in Nevada, give Senator Jeff Flake some trouble in Arizona, and on and on.
Right. I mean, I cited Kelly Ward, the primary challenger to Senator Jeff Flake in Arizona, whose poll numbers are abysmal. It does look like she will probably be successful in picking him off in a primary. The question is, when it comes to a general election, how successful she'll be. And I think it's difficult to say right now because we don't know enough about what the electorate will look like for 2018 or what the forces will be. But she has very little in common with somebody like Roy Moore. The same is true of a potential rock candidacy in Michigan. But, you know, Paula Page gets in the race in Maine, which is certainly a possibility. I don't know. He's been elected statewide, too.
That's a great point. Well, you know, speaking of future general elections, let's take a moment to entertain just now. Roy Moore won the primary. He hasn't actually yet been elected to the Senate. He still has a general election in December, the special election to win for the seat. Does Democrat Doug Jones have a chance, Charlie?
What is it, the Democratic pornography segment? No, it's not going to happen because, I mean, Alabama is one of the most conservative states in the country. President Trump is not just popular there. He is wildly popular there. Roy Moore has won statewide there before. And here's the other fact to keep in mind. No Democratic Senate nominee has even cracked 40% in two decades. Not even 40%. So it's hard for me to see. And you know, if it was ever going to happen, maybe it would be now against Moore, because not only does Moore have his flaws, Jones is, you know, a pretty good candidate in a lot of ways. He's a straight arrow. He's got a compelling biography as a former U.S. attorney who was involved in prosecuting individuals involved in the 16th Street bombing. He's a good candidate. He'll get lots of money and lots of national attention. But just the dynamics in Alabama are just too the forces are too powerful to overcome.
In particular, there's a comparison that's been floating around, which I thought was interesting, that Alabama went about as strongly for Trump in 2016 as Massachusetts did for former President Barack Obama in 2008. And then a little over, a year and a half later, we saw Scott Brown, a Republican, get elected in Massachusetts. But things are a little – it's not quite – you can't quite make the one-to-one comparison, right, because of how racially polarized voting is in the South. There's a lot fewer swing voters in Alabama that kind of bop around the way they do in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and I think there were some other sort of place-specific factors in Massachusetts. Coakley was known already, so I think as a known elected politician, you carry some baggage that isn't necessarily there for – I think more – I mean –
Well, Moore definitely has baggage.
Yeah.
Moore has a lot of baggage.
Okay, so that's a bad
frame. But it's baggage the people of Alabama love.
Everybody knows, and it's baggage that has created a base. I mean, that is an asset to a fixed amount of voters in that state. I think Coakley was just a very different kind of character. And also, keep in mind that, you know, given how polarized things are now and how angry voters on each side of the fence are, you know, I look at each race. Who is the middle finger candidate? You know, if you just hate everything and want to burn it all down, who's your option? In that race, your option was Scott Brown. In this race, your option is Roy Moore.
Is that what we have to look forward to in 2018, the middle finger election? Is that going to be what historians call this?
The FU election.
Perhaps it makes some sense to go from talking about the middle finger candidate and the middle finger election to what we want to talk about in segment three. Our data point for our final segment this week is $8.3 million. And that's how much money was donated to President Donald Trump's political committees and inaugural committee over the past few years by NFL owners who found themselves in the center of one of Trump's almost patented cultural controversies last weekend. And it started in Alabama, actually. It started at Trump's rally for Luther Strange. Let's take a listen.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
Trump went on to double down on Twitter again and again over the weekend, sparking wider protests during the weekend's NFL games with more players taking knees, owners standing with players. And it's not letting up this week. Just today, Trump was saying that he came out and said it because he, in his view, some of the owners are afraid of the players and they don't want to speak out. So he is. Charlie, sports and politics, especially the politics of race, have been intertwined for a long time in this country. But conflict between a president and a league, or a league full of players, and from the players all the way up to the owners, seems to me to have broken new ground this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly taking this to another level. I mean, all of us are familiar with the stories of, you know, 1968 Olympics, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, all of whom were highly politicized characters in addition to being great sports stars. But what's remarkable here is how the president has engaged, how the president has inflamed it. And what's also remarkable to me is that it's revealing how the president, how his political instincts work. I mean, I think he understands and sees this as a cultural wedge issue. One of the things he doesn't get credit for is how sharp and incisive his political instincts are. He smelled this out a while ago, and he is just mining it right now. He may not do – there are a lot of things he does not do well as the president, but he does have a good antenna for a political issue, and this really speaks to his base.
Charlie, you've looked at some of the polling also that's been done on this, right? I mean, it's happened quickly because this story has been evolving quickly, but there was some Snap polling this week kind of teasing out a little bit of what you're saying here.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell, you know, because we don't have a huge body of it in the aftermath. But a lot of it reveals what you'd think. A lot of this is generational in terms of how you perceive it. And when you think about the Trump base, many of whom are over 65 years old and white, you know, those are the kinds of folks that really his words resonate with them, and they do not want to see what they view as disrespect for the flag and the country, and it does not play well with them. And so ultimately, this could adhere to his advantage with the people he cares the most about.
Eliana, I'm curious your view on how this all got started. I mean, do you see this as a calculated move in the culture wars, or potentially something that may have been sparked in a moment by something he saw on TV?
I think Trump has a subconscious ability to change the subject when he knows he's in trouble. And so not sure it was a conscious calculation. A White House aide told me he probably was watching football on TV and I think subconsciously got this in his mind that it was a good way to change the subject. But certainly when – What is 100% certain is this was not in his scripted remarks in that rally in Alabama. But I think when he made the remarks, he saw the crowd's reaction. One thing led to another, and he is not moving off the issue. What I did think was probably the best thing I've read about this was Ross Douthat's column in The Times about how culture wars can be very useful, but that Trump has an ability to incite culture wars that aren't necessarily about real issues, and that standing or kneeling for the flag, it has no relevance to policy necessarily. And so he takes social and cultural debates that could be useful and makes them about himself, and focuses on debates that really have no relation to politics and policy, which is so different from debates about gay marriage or sexual morality, or which I thought was sort of the most interesting analysis I saw come out of
or
this.
Or racial inequities in policing, right. Which is
exactly
how this all started, right?
Exactly.
Which has been lost in a lot of the – certainly a lot of the coverage about this. And I think, you know, some of the players in the NFL who have been kneeling for the national anthem have been trying to steer the conversation back that way. But now it's also about Trump, and he's wrapped up in this in a way that he wasn't before, even when he was, you know, speaking out on the other side of the issue a lot at his rallies and so on and so forth. The extent to which he and politics more generally is invading just every corner of public life is remarkable.
But he also understands how politics is increasingly driven by pop culture.
Yeah.
And I think he understands that in a way that many politicians do not. And he also understands the value of having elites line up against them. And in our culture today, you have to think of sports stars as elites, along with, you know, all the other folks that he rails against, New York intellectuals or whatever it might be. And so I think ultimately this just feeds the sense of grievance that drives much of the Trump
coalition.
That's
what I'm not sure about. If you, sports stars are the same as – I mean, look, conservatives typically – rail against Hollywood elites and the news media, but they're not typically aligned against business interests, which the president has, you know, he lost all these members of his business councils and stuff in the White House. They're not typically aligned against athletes. So I'm not exactly sure how this will play out. I think it's interesting because polling suggests that the majority of Americans don't like it when athletes kneel for the national anthem, but they also support somebody's ability to do it or not do it. So it's kind of unclear. But I do think that overall it kind of increases the president's isolation from broader American culture, and that he is already alienated from the media, Hollywood, business more broadly, and now he's alienated from sort of broader athletic universe.
But I do think that conservatives will be forced or are in the process of changing their mind about for business. If, for example, think about Silicon Valley. Are there any conservatives who think that Silicon Valley it has not picked sides on this? And I think Trump understands that, you know, by taking after Facebook and saying Facebook is anti-Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think he's plugging into that. And I think Trump has an uncanny ability to see where these issues are going in the future and plug into them.
I'm just curious where this goes with the sports world in particular. I mean, what happened? Does this become a recurring story every week as the NFL season goes on? What happens when the NBA season gets started soon? A league with players and coaches and owners, we should say, who have been much more even more outspoken about racial issues and Trump himself than the NFL as a body of players. I mean, is this going to become a weekly or daily, bit of culture war combat between Trump and black athletes, kind of going forward? And how does that affect his presidency? How does that affect politics? How does that affect sports?
I think it has to burn out at some point. I mean, how much longer can people continue to talk about this? But I do think where it goes politically is, you know, as I've said, I'm convinced it works to his advantage, not with the broad cross-section of Americans, but with his base. And that is who he cares about. He doesn't care about what anyone else thinks. He cares about whether it is energizing his people, because he needs to get every last one of them out if he has any hope of winning a second term.
I should say at this moment, we did talk last week about how his approval rating has seemed to be ticking up a little bit recently. That has appears to have arrested this week, at least in Gallup and a few of the other polls that are out there. And again, it's so hard to peg this to any one particular thing or catalyst because, as we talked about, Trump is doing so many things at once that it's impossible to pull all together. I'm really curious to see what happens and how this develops, and I have no earthly clue, you know, what the next step is going to be. We have joked the last few weeks about the Nerdcast curse. So definitely, we're not expecting when we recorded the podcast last week that Trump was going to start like a war with the NFL the next day.
And I can't claim to know anything more about where the polling is going to go either. But one of the things that strikes me is we have an unusually clear snapshot of the level of support for Donald Trump. It's different than other presidents. Meaning, think about George Bush, George W. Bush, who gets elected. His numbers rise; they go stratospheric after 9/11. And typically, with other presidents, you see their numbers bounce high, bounce low, depending on different events. I think what we now know about Trump is his numbers are always going to be in a narrow band. I think we may have learned what the floor is during some of the darker days of the disastrous first 6 months. So we know how low he can go, and he probably can't get any lower than that because his base will never ever leave him. And I think now we're going to get a sense of, you know, what is the ceiling for that? And it's probably going to be low to mid 40s because if he does run again, he will not win with 50%. And ultimately, I think the 2020 election gets determined on who the Democratic nominee is, because Trump probably hits a ceiling at low 40s, which is what we're seeing right now. I mean, can you really envision many scenarios in which he goes much higher than that, given the level of disdain that Democrats have for him and given how poorly his numbers operate among independents? I mean, does anyone imagine that he can win 50% of the vote 2020? Eliana, do you have any sense he could win over 50%?
No.
Yeah.
So he's always in the low 40s. What you're saying makes sense. I would just say I think
– No, but you have a look on your face that is total BS.
We have to suspend our disbelief sometimes with these – like what happened in the last election surprised a lot of people because there was essentially a failure of imagination. It was like impossible to imagine that Trump could win, and so – I'm reluctant to foreclose on the prospect of him somehow becoming popular. It certainly is difficult to imagine.
I'm not saying he can't win. Like I thought he could win in 2016. I didn't think he would win, but I thought he could win. And I also think he can win in 2020. But I think he's going to have to figure out a way to win with low 40s popularity.
All right. Well, as always, a story that we will be tracking in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Charlie, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it today.
Thanks, Scott.
And Eliana, thank you as well.
Thanks.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, if you have questions for us, please email at nerdcast@politico.com. And remember, subscribe, rate us, and if you have time, write a written review of the Nerdcast at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. So once again, thank you to our panel. Thanks to our listeners. Thanks to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our producer in the studio this week, Matt Sobosinski, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Politico playbook producer and Nerdcast researcher, Zach Montalaro. That's it for us. We will talk to you again next week.